Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. As the Russian invasion of Ukraine enters a third month, its brutality escalating all the time, prospects of ending the conflict are still really nowhere in sight. For all the astounding resolve of Ukrainians, we're looking at a relatively small country up against one of the world's largest militaries, and there seems to be no limit to Vladimir Putin's destructive impulses. Ukraine's most senior diplomat is Sergei Kislytsa, the country's permanent representative to the United Nations. Kislytsa has spent his entire career in Ukraine's foreign service, trying to avoid precisely the kind of catastrophe that's playing out now. And I talked with him last week. Now, when you listen to the rhetoric of Putin, when you hear his version of history, this mystical, selective version of history, what is happening here? What's your analysis of what Putin wants and why he decided to invade your country?
It cannot be analyzed from the scientific or scholarly point of view. His narrative and his vision and his speeches, they are beyond the academic world and how the classic historians and sociologists see the history. So it is rather to be analyzed by politicians, if not psychiatrists. So the narrative he advances, nevertheless, is still popular and very attractive to the majority of the Russians.
Why?
Well, let's go back to Germany after the Treaty of Versailles. And
it's following World War One.
Right, and see how and why Hitler was successful in selling to the majority, overwhelming majority of the Germans, this narrative about grievances, about Germany unjustly stripped of powers, of economic opportunities, and how Germany should revive itself by expanding, you know, by militarizing. So, in fact, what happens in Russia is very similar to what happened in Germany. And the way the overwhelming majority of the Russian population is brainwashed is very similar to what happened to the Germans. And that is why it is utterly wrong to believe that we should celebrate our victory the day or the next day Russia is defeated militarily in Ukraine. Because when it happens, and it will happen, it will be just the beginning of a very long process of inviting and facilitating the process of returning of Russia to the path, very long path, to developing a democratic nation. The nation that is, in case of Germany, was denazified, and in case of Russia, it should be deputinized.
Well, this is jumping ahead to a victory.
Right.
Let's where we are now is in another phase of the war, in which, on the one hand, we are discovering, if these accounts can be trusted, and I, you know, quite frankly, with reporters on the ground from The New Yorker and elsewhere, I see no reason to distrust them. We're finding mass graves in Mariupol. We're finding evidence of what could turn out to be war crimes, and I'm stating this quite conservatively, in Bucha, in all kinds of places. And at the same time, a renewed assault from Russia in the east that may lack finesse and skill, but is certainly brutal, and Russia has a great deal of ordnance and firepower. What do you think Russia is aiming toward? What is its end game?
I'm sure you know it very well because you studied Russia, you lived in Russia, and you probably know that for the Russians and the Soviets, the notion of symbolism is so important. For when we speak about next couple of weeks...
You think May 9th is a big deal?
May 9th is absolutely...
This is the day of, that we...
sacral, right. You know, something so holy.
This celebrating the end of the Great Patriotic War and the Soviet role and victory in it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So they have to have something to give Putin so he can show up in the Red Square and address his crowd and declare a war. So they would not really care how many Russian soldiers should be killed to be able to give this something to Putin. Let me remind you, and you know it probably very well yourself, the cost of taking Kiev in 1943 in November. When Stalin ordered to retake Kiev from the Nazis by the 7th of November, which is the so-called Bolshevik Revolution Day, just to have Kiev recaptured, and it was retaken by the 6th of November, hundreds, literally hundreds of thousands of Soviet troops died, were drawn in Kiev, in the Dnieper River, for no reason. They could have designed much smarter military operation to take Kiev back in a couple of weeks later.
I think what you're telling me then is what you're expecting, and we're talking now in late April, you're expecting horrendous butchery in the east of Ukraine in order to make a May 9th deadline.
Not only in the east. The thing is that they lack necessary personnel strengths in the front, but they still have enough missiles, both ballistic and other missiles, that can hit as far as Lviv in the west. So they will escalate attacks by missiles and from the sky to terrorize Ukraine in general and to, in their seeing of the situation, to make the government more susceptible to surrender.
Now, this must be for you as a human being horrible. You've been here many months. I assume you have lots and lots of family and friends. Where are you from?
I'm from the capital.
You're from Kiev.
Right.
Where's your family?
My family, except with a couple of members of my family, are in a safe locations. I cannot disclose them for the security reasons, but there is quite a number. There are at least of two family members who cannot leave Kiev. My sister, for example, she lives in a place where, not far away from Kiev, where all buildings but her building, her house, and two houses of her neighbors are totally destroyed.
North of Kiev, probably.
Yep.
What has she seen? What has she experienced?
She would call my family members in the middle of the shelling, and you can listen on the phone, you can hear rather on the phone, the shelling, and she would scream, she would be totally terrified.
Mm.
And I think the only reason, ironically, she didn't leave, because she has animals on her farm. She used to be a very urban, you know, Kievite, and one day she decided many years ago, like, she would like to live on a farm. So she moved from the city to the farm, and now she didn't leave because she has animals.
Do you tell her to get out of there? Or?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's amazing. I mean, it's...
She won't leave.
No. It's amazing because you probably saw in the media many, many examples of how people would really sacrifice to take their cats and dogs and you name it, to save them.
You must be fearful for her life all the time.
You know, I try to firewall myself being very cynical.
How do you mean?
I try not to engage emotionally. Because if I engage emotionally too much, I am not operational. And if I'm not operational as Ukraine's permanent representative to the UN, I'm of very little use for my government.
Do you always succeed in holding your emotions back?
Yeah, that's why I gain weight. Seriously. No. I try. Even in the Security Council, when I sit there and I listen all those malarkey coming from Putin's representatives on the council, you know, at first I was trying to listen to them carefully, then I thought, what the hell? I mean, nobody really believes them.
Sergei Kislytsia is the permanent representative of Ukraine to the United Nations. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I've been speaking with Sergei Kislytsia. He's Ukraine's permanent representative to the UN and one of the country's most senior diplomats. Kislytsia is 52, and he spent his career in this work beginning as an intern in the foreign ministry. So he's watched the entire era of post-Soviet politics play out, the tense relationship between Ukraine and Russia, and he's seen it from very close up. Now, I imagine you sit long days in the United Nations, and when you think about it, what good is it doing? In other words, do you sit in that chamber and you think this place could be a source of political resolution, or you think to yourself, this body is impotent?
The United Nations is not an ideal institution. By design, and especially when it comes to the 21st century and the challenges of the 21st century. And why should it be ideal? I mean, we shall remind our listeners that the United Nations was conceived by three fathers, Roosevelt, Churchill, and the pure evil Stalin. So the United Nations has in its DNA Stalin's DNA as well. Well, later on, at a later stage, they allowed the Chinese to join and the French to join when the Vichy government was removed. So why something conceived by evil will be perfect? No.
You're referring to veto power from...
I refer to the fact that in Yalta and later on in San Francisco, and they designed the organization that allowed the permanent members to control the decision-making.
Let me ask you this. This week, Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, made it very plain, what I think Putin also believes, and he's made plain as well, that this is not necessarily a war between Russia and Ukraine, but rather it's a proxy war between Russia and the West, Russia and principally the United States. Now, Ukrainians get to be the victims in this, but in a geostrategic sense, is that true?
Ukrainians are indeed the victims of a long sequence of events that brought us all, including the collective West, to the point where we has this monster, this evil, capable of waging the war. Because the collective West, beginning from 1991, gave too much credit to Moscow. to begin with, how the Russian Federation was allowed to seize the seat in the Security Council. And then, now and then, Russia would do something ugly. And instead of properly reacting to the Russian actions, be it Moldova, Transnistria, be it invasion of Georgia, be it Syria, we were putting a fresh layer of paint over yet another crime by Russia. And now we are surprised. How come Russia feels so
aggrieved?
Powerful.
Do you sense that Russia thought the West was weak? In other words, after so many failed interventions and half interventions, after Iraq, after Libya, after the failure to do anything about Syria, whether that was a good idea, a terrible idea, or what, do you feel that above all, that Putin sensed the United States and the West was weak, and that this latest assault on Ukraine that he could have just marched through?
Yeah, I think partly it explains. I wouldn't really name the person who told me. That person was present in one of the G8 dinners 12 years ago or so.
But an American?
It doesn't really matter. But that person was present at a dinner where Putin was addressing the G8 members. And Putin basically said, all right, you guys take care of Western Europe, Central Europe, and you let us take care of the rest.
Meaning Eastern Europe.
Eastern Europe.
So it's like Yalta all over again.
Right.
Yeah.
And that person told me nobody reacted. They continued to have their desserts and coffee.
Mm.
So Putin walked out of the meeting, technically able to say, I told them. And I heard no opposition to what I told. You know? And I can give you so many examples of this complacency of all of us that led us to...
When you say of all of us, you count Ukraine as well?
Including Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Including Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine until 2014 had this clear case of cognitive dissonance when it comes to foreign policy. We wanted to be with Russia, but integrating to the West. We wanted to be with Brussels, making friendship with Moscow. We wanted to be neutral, at the same time telling that we want to be NATO members. So this was kind of a chaotic, no synergy, you know. So only after 2014, we finally got rid of these dissonance. And if something made us willing to join NATO so much, that's Russia, that personally Putin.
Now, as you know, George Kennan, who was a superb analyst of Russian history and behavior, was against NATO expansion before he died at, I think he was 100 and something years old when he died. And this is often brought out by various people now as a Western mistake, NATO expansion in the Baltic states, in Poland. And then there was a moment when NATO membership was not quite offered to Ukraine and Georgia, but it was kind of half offered. It was certainly offered as a possibility. Did that help or hurt Ukraine? And how do you see the whole NATO argument?
I think that it it hurt Ukraine on a systematic nature basis. We lost our chances, as I said, but it happened during the Bucharest summit, and when the Bucharest summit took place, as I said, we still had the government that was not really, you know, clear, and this cognitive dissonance, as I call it, was very much present. So even if we were given the chance to integrate to NATO on a fast track, I'm not sure that the government was totally on board.
To take it.
Right, to take it.
President Zelensky repeatedly has, in any number of venues and in any number of languages and in varying and very effective moods, talked about, first he begins by thanking this country or that organization, and then not imploring them, but demanding of them much more, materially, militarily, and politically. In what condition is the Ukrainian army now that you've gotten all kinds of aid packages from the United States and from many places? What is the level of Ukrainian need, in your view, at this time?
I think that on a scale of 5, we are doing a very solid 4. Let us look at, for example, at morale. Morale is very high, very high. The Ukrainians are fighting on their territory, and the Ukrainians are very motivated to defend their homes and their families. The Russian morale is very low. They are fighting on the foreign territory. They have no clue, many of them, why the hell Putin sent them to Ukraine and what the hell they are doing there. We were successful in changing the tide of the attitude of the major suppliers of arms and weapons. When after the initial wrong belief in many capitals that we would be defeated in 2 to 5 days, they realized that we are not only defeated, but we also successfully defend our territory, and in some cases we advance.
Now, earlier in our conversation, you said it's inevitable, I think that's the word you use, inevitable, that Ukraine will win its victory, and then that will begin a process as well in Russia. Is it inevitable? We hear threats, unveiled threats from Moscow about the potential use of nuclear weapons. We've had intelligence reports reported in the press about the possible use of chemical weapons. What makes you so sure that Ukrainian victory is inevitable?
When you have 93% of population after 65, 67 days of war, so solidly, strongly reunited, when only 2% of population says they are completely exhausted by the war, you realize that there is no other way. Let me give you one figure that is not that often mentioned. We all hear about 4+ million Ukrainians who left Ukraine in the course of the last 2 months, seeking refuge and protection in neighboring countries and beyond. But how many of your listeners know that 1 million of Ukrainians came back to Ukraine to defend Ukraine? So we have no shortage, unlike the Russians, who do not declare war and they are not being able to mobilize. We have no shortage in Ukrainians willing to fight. We have shortage or mismatch in the kind of weapons we need to have to be even more effective in defending our country and doing so in defending Europe and beyond.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sergei Kislytsia is the permanent representative of Ukraine to the United Nations. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This week on our podcast, The Writer's Voice, Sheila Hedy reads her short story, Just a Little Fever. It's about a young woman working as a bank teller and maybe a little impulsive, who embarks on an affair with an elderly customer at the bank.
They were sitting across from each other in a dim red room, and waiters were walking about in soft shoes, carrying things on trays in their careful and deliberate ways. She liked the candlelight. She liked the spaghetti carbonara, and she liked Thomas, whom she had started calling Tom. He didn't seem charmed by her, though, and remained as uneasy as he had been on the phone. "You like old men?" he finally asked. It was the question that had been plaguing him. "Not more than I like young men." "Lots of people don't like old men. They think that we're disgusting, old-fashioned, out of date, that our values are not contemporary, and that there's something wrong with our bodies." "I don't think that," she said. He nodded but was not reassured. "Is this a date?" he asked. She admitted that it probably was. She said, "I liked that you didn't say that I should start exercising and eating right, and I also liked your suit, and your white hair is so nice and fluffy like a little Persian cat." "Thank you," he said. He had been complimented in this way before. Lots of women liked him. Angela wasn't the only one.
That's Sheila Hedy reading on our podcast, The Writer's Voice, and you can read her story, Just a Little Fever, at newyorker.com. Right from the start, Ricky Lee Jones was a unique talent. Her debut album was nominated for 5 Grammys in 1980, and she won Best New Artist that year. Jones brought together a singer-songwriter's attention to lyrics and storytelling with a jazz artist's creative freedom with her voice. One of her very best songs on that debut album was called Last Chance Texaco, and Ricky Lee Jones made that the title of her recent memoir. Producer Scott Carrier went to talk with her in New Orleans.
Okay, so it's Sunday morning, March 21st, and I'm in New Orleans, Louisiana. Just walking down Rampart, going over to Jamie Del Appa's house to talk to Ricky Lee Jones. Ricky and Jamie are friends. And Jamie wrote to me and asked me if I would like to do a story about Ricky's new memoir, Last Chance Texaco, which to me was kind of like a miracle because I've always sort of really loved Ricky Lee Jones' music and followed her career. I mean, I started listening to her albums in college and I still listen to them now that I'm 64. And I've always kind of felt like she's my guardian angel because her music makes me feel like everything's going to be okay. And, you know, she's right, usually. But, so, they sent me her book, and I read it, and I really had no idea. I mean, her book is about her life as a growing up, leading up to when she makes it big. So, it's not really about being a rock star superstar. It's about, she had a really kind of a rough childhood and she ended up running away repeatedly through high school. And the stories in the book are, in a way, really sad. You know, a lot of bad things happened to her when she was traveling around. She got thrown in jail quite a few times as a teenager. And I just had no idea from listening to her music what a rough life she had growing up. But now that I've read the book, I can see how those rough experiences, those tough times, are where her songs come from. She describes it as like ripping out a piece of herself in writing her songs. So when I was reading the book, first thing I recognized that she writes with a sense of rhythm that comes from her music, but it also comes just from American literature. Rhythm, I think, in American literature is the most important thing, and she does it really well. She writes in a natural voice, saying more with less. I thought when I was reading the book, this sounds an awful lot like Huck Finn talking. It's the same clear, honest voice of someone traveling around the country, traveling around America, trying to figure out what she's seeing, what she's looking at, which is cruelty, stupidity, and violence mixed in with comedy. Even though they're sad stories, it's very fun to read them. They're sad, but she writes about it in a way you can tell she just really enjoyed it, traveling around. So I came here and got to talk to her, met her, interviewed her the first time. And that went really pretty well. And then I talked to her again yesterday and was asking her to tell me some of the stories that are in the book. But in telling them, she just, I think I wore her out because the stories in the book are so sad, and I was having her tell me some of the stories, and she got to a certain point where she just couldn't do it anymore, and we had to stop. So at that point I thought, man, I've really blown it. But she's gonna give me another hour now, today, before I leave town. When I arrive at Jamie's house, Ricky is there waiting for me. She says, get out your tape recorder. I've got something I want to tell you.
So, there are sometimes all kinds of creatures who come in the guise of journalists. And sometimes they're succubus. And they come to eat you. And you leave. I leave in a short time, feeling more worn out than any tour or any album making or anything. In 2 hours, a bad journalist can suck me from my life force. I wanted to say you are the opposite of that. I leave your presence feeling so... I would never set you up that way anyway, but I wanted to because I knew you'd... But listen to me now. I leave your presence so strong and no part of me penetrated or touched. And everything I say to you is, I feel good about what I said.
Thank you for saying that. It really makes me... lifts a load.
Sure.
What I would like to talk about is, did you enjoy traveling around? Let's just talk about traveling.
All I wanted to do was leave. And, you know, when I talk about it from here, it seems like it was so horribly dangerous. But I guess it wasn't, because something called me out to these adventures, yes? And even though I met terribly dangerous people and I brushed against their coats, they just passed on by, because that writer was writing these stories.
So explain. Tell me that.
Yes. This sense that I have that I'm not the only guy writing my life, that others are writing it too. And I am escorted through horrible things right out the other side. So it feels like the words I'm reading are put down by life itself, not just me.
So did you feel that when you started out? You're 14, and you take off from home in a Camaro, stolen Camaro, with your boyfriend,
yeah.
And you drive to the ocean, the beach, California. Is that when it started?
I'm sure I was at the beginning of a great adventure. I wanted to grow up. I wanted to be a grown-up, so I wanted to get out there and live grown-up things. I didn't want to sit in a classroom anymore and have people say, take your hat off, and I want to talk about arithmetic. I'm done with that, you know.
There was that time when you took off, you're walking down Electric Avenue uh-huh. and going home uh-huh. for dinner, and instead you just stick out your thumb and decide to hitchhike to Big Sur.
So I read somewhere that there's some maybe people who've been molested or some, I can't remember what it was, but that this impulse control is a problem for a kind of people. And it made me start really going, did something happen to me? Because I have, it was impossible for me to control. Suddenly I'll go, I think I'll go to Big Sur, and I'm in a car going. And the chaos and trouble that brings to a life. But I can't find any evidence of anything like that happening to me. I just seem to be a creature that that does well acting impulsively. Let's go to the desert and see what's there. Other people need to plan it. And that's good too. But for me, I find gold if I go right now. And in my case, I think I'm just so deeply optimistic that I have a way of making all these events good. I just love living and can't, I mean, I have actually suffered from depression, but for the most part, I just can't turn life into a bad story.
We will fly way up high where the cold wind blows, or in the sun laughing, having fun with all the people that you know. And if the situation should keep us separated, you know the world won't fall. And you will free the beautiful bird that's caught inside your heart. Can't you hear her? Oh, she cries so loud, cast her wild notes over water and cloud. That's the way it's gonna be, little darling. We'll be riding on the horse in the air, way up.
So when I was little, I never had shoes on, and the days were so hot and so incredibly long that I think I lived years in a day. That was how I wrote that song, Years May Go By, because when I think of that year, 61, when I'm six, it takes forever for the day to go by. So you could start out in the morning in the backyard making mud pies and eating mint and watching the garbage and the men go by. And then you go in and listen to the radio and then take a walk down by the well and find an animal, a live animal. Any animal was a thrill to me. If it was a frog, I didn't have any prejudice against the kind of animals that were magical to me, so.
How about the story where you're riding the bike down the street and a car stops right in front of you?
Well, I was riding my brother's bicycle, and his seat was too high for me to sit on, so I had to just pedal standing up. And so I couldn't get off the bike, and I was down at the end of the street riding around in circles when a car drove up really fast. And where I was riding, so on the straight line here is where civilization ended, and the farmers still had his big farm there. So our houses ran along the edge of the farm. Here's where the garbage men were, and here's where that irrigation thing was where I put the frog, and here's my school. So I was riding around there, and a car came up and had to stop at the field. And a car was right in back of him, pulled up too. I'm riding around in a circle watching. And the man in the first car got out, red-haired man. In the second car, mean, angry man got out and started hitting the man from the other car. To me, they were grown men. Later, my mother told me that the redhead was 17 years old, but to me, they were all grown-ups. And they were crying and swearing, and they must have indicated something in the back seat of the first car, I don't know. So I walked over and looked in, and there was a little girl there, a little tiny girl, about two. She was laying in the back seat. But like I wrote, I don't know what I saw, because she had been raped by the 17-year-old, and the man hitting the 17-year-old was her father, who'd... The kid used to babysit her, and then one day, I don't know if he'd been molesting her all along, but he took her from the home, and the father got wise to it and went and tried to find him, chased him to that place where I was riding my bike around in a circle. So they were all over the place, and pedophiles were lining up to claim the innocent. You better believe it. And they share a lot of them in Phoenix, or were, you know.
The most is you'll ever go is back where you used to know. If grown-ups could laugh this slow, whereas you watch the hours snow, years may go by. Years may go by.
Your family moved a lot. Almost constantly. Sometimes you went to three different schools in 1 year. One year you went to four different schools in 1 year. Well, always on moving from one place.
You know, my imagination started to make me go, were they running from somebody? Like, so I can't really understand why two grown-ups would move their family so often. But they did it, yeah.
Maybe they felt free when they were moving on the road. Felt freedom. Is that what?
I think you hit it on the head. Well, I don't know why I never thought that, but you know, that her growing up in the orphanage, being a prisoner as a child, and him growing up without his mother, which just destroyed him, and that cruel father. So I'll bet you that's exactly what it was. And they didn't want to be itinerant, right? They didn't want to be people without, you know, they didn't want to be bums. When I was 18, Mark Vaughn took a Polaroid of me and wrote, Ricky Lee, the itinerant stranger. And for many years, I saved that and went, I wonder what that word means. And then I looked it up and it meant the one who has no home or always moves around, I think. Right?
Here I'm going, walking with my baby more. So I'm in the wrong, in the bubble, in the double.
You've been all over the country and lived in Europe, so many different places. Why did you decide to come and move to New Orleans?
I have lived in a lot of places. Paris, Tacoma, California. I came here because I needed to leave there. I needed to leave L.A. I was thinking of leaving the country again, but that just, it's so hard, you know, when you don't speak the language, and there's just, it's so isolating, and I knew what I needed was to not be isolated anymore. And I took a chance on this place, and it was a bit of a struggle. I'm a solitary and kind of reclusive, have been for some time, and the human beings I know, as well as the city itself, says none of that and pulls you out everywhere you go. They want you to come out and live. And I went and stayed with Barry and Mary when I first got here. Barry, I had been my neighbor when I lived here before, and he'd married this woman named Mary, and I was staying up in their basement. And so I went out with them to a parade, and I was thinking, or costumes or whatever they're doing, I was just thinking, this is stupid. Why are all these people walking around like, what the? And she said, stop being such a loser. And I was like, what did you say to me? And it was very rude. But her gruff and rough words were her way of saying, come out and play.
This is a big question. Do you feel at all? This is your home. Do you still feel like running away?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. It's in my nature. And I watch for signs. And, you know, I'm trying to teach myself to tough it out if it gets tough. But my nature is, if it gets too tough, you don't have to stay. You don't have to die. You don't have to die inside. There's a whole wide world out there. Just go somewhere new and start again. It's a flaw in my character because when push comes to shove, I got my foot out the door. But it's also a way to survive. Being watchful for the sign that the good things will be taken away. So you ask me, I am watching. I'm watchful. I'll always be watchful. Well, I can't say that. Maybe one day I'll go, ah, but not yet.
Watchful for time to leave?
Yes, watchful for the time to leave. Yes.
Your last chance to trust the man who's died. 'Cause you found the last chance takes echo. The last chance.
Ricky Lee Jones's new memoir, Last Chance Texaco, is out now. Scott Carrier reported for the New Yorker Radio Hour, and you can hear more of his work on his podcast, Home of the Brave. I'm David Remnick, and before we go, I want to send my love and gratitude to my dear colleague, Dorothy Wickenden. We've worked together so closely for so many years at the New Yorker, and back in 2007, when podcasting was still a bit of an experiment, Dorothy stepped up to host the show that became Politics and More. Dorothy is leaving The New Yorker, as an editor at least, to focus on writing books and writing pieces for the magazine. And we wish her the very best. That's The New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thank you for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, Gofen and Putubwele.
And we had additional help this week from Andrew Dunn.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.